You're listening to Back in USSR.
Yeah, this track deals with the troubles arising in Eastern Europe, which could very soon spread over to here if you're not careful. Our base instincts in check. School.
The demon's rising again, and this time a great crisis. No surprise that it's rising into crisis. Encouraged by betrayals of so-called socialists. Encouraged from the coffers of big business. The black shirts march again in German towns. Handing out beatdowns, murdering blacks and browns. And even whites they consider inferior. Consider themselves superior. Hitler resurrected. The male disrespected. Printing a diary, giving a platform to a Nazi. These are dangerous times, so please wake up and understand what's up with the countries of Europe and in France. The NF gets votes and cutthroats, and the port of Marseille is the fascist mainstay, and nationalism feeds the fires of hate. We need to demonstrate and physically decimate this racist, anti-communist crew. Kill one or two and beat the rest of them blue. Or should I say red, cause there's no quarter given or asked for, cause that's how we're living. And so I gotta ask you this then, is it just evil or to do with the system that creates nation states and racial hates, decides our fates and then devastates like the destruction it caused in World War II? Now in 92, are we going back to the day of the jackboot, or will we change forever? I don't know about you, but I go hell for leather. Beat the fascists down like they got beat at Waterloo. They're as strong as we're weak. True indeed, true indeed, true.
Well, we got troubles coming from the east side. Troubles from the east side. We got troubles coming from the east side.
Yeah, trouble again. And the world is getting nervous. Oh, mankind, you got to be conscious. Yeah.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Marxman with the Fascist Boom. And you're listening to Back in the USSR, Rebel Music Radio, with your host, Siegfried Berezov. Now, tonight, I really want to talk about something which I should have talked about, like, earlier. I mean, last week, unfortunately, I was not here. I had a previous engagement, so I couldn't actually do the show. So I had to put on a previously played show, you know, one that I did. Like, I think it was the show that was on the first Saturday of this month or something like that, the one I actually put on. But I really want to get around to talking about Syria, because that is really all over the headlines now. That's what's getting talked about, you know, the escalation of violence in that country, the escalation of the imperialist intervention in that country from the United States, you know, flying basically bombing missions over the country, and also doing the same thing in Iraq right now. You know, for the first time in like years, you know, U.S. forces basically are back inside Iraq, you know. So we have to recognize the danger of the situation in the Middle East right now, you know, and really what it means for the region, what it means for the people of the region, and the fact that, of course, there's nothing new about this, you know, imperial powers like the United States and like, well, going back to the British and the French, intervening in this part of the world to secure their economic and political interests. You know, this is a very old story. So I really want to talk about this tonight. Later on, I'll talk a little about, of course, I'll mention Scottish independence, because that's been a pretty big thing on the airwaves these days, and kind of like the process. There's been a lot of misunderstandings on that front, too, especially even people on the left don't exactly understand the whole push for Scottish independence and what it means. And a little later on, I'll talk about, I'll play a talk by Michael Parenti about the U.S. attack on Yugoslavia, because frankly, I think it's a pretty enlightening example, given what's going on in the world today. You know, with intervention in Syria and Iraq, and just given just how far imperialist nations like the United States will go to secure their interests at the expense of everybody else. So I'm going to start with the war on Syria, though. And the first thing that we have to say is the war on Syria has raged for more than 3 years now, and the death toll has surpassed, it's at least 150,000 now, with literally millions of people displaced or forced to flee their homes as refugees. You know, and this, frankly, this is a crime. This is the destruction of a proud an ancient country with roots going back 5,000 years, and it's a crime of imperialism. And it's every bit as evil as the imperialism that devastated Nicaragua in the 1980s. In the 1980s Contra Wars. And it's almost identical in its methods. Since 2001, or perhaps even before 2001, if veteran investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, if his reports are correct, the United States and its regional allies, you know, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and a few others, have been funding a brutal insurgency in Syria. Now, they're doing it quite openly now, actually. You know, giving money, giving guns to these so-called rebels. An insurgency that in the same form as the Nicaraguan Contras, just as the Nicaraguan Contras were trying to overthrow the Sandinista revolutionary government in Nicaragua 25 years ago, the Syrian rebels have not confined their attacks to military targets, but they've actively waged war against the Syrian people themselves. You know, they've attacked schools, they've attacked hospitals, they've attacked universities, water systems, power plants, all manner of public infrastructure has just been systematically destroyed. You know, that's obviously to say nothing about the massacres, beheadings, abductions, slavery, human trafficking, you know, and what have you, that's perpetuated by the insurgents themselves. You know, particularly with regard to Syrian minorities like Kurds, Christians, Shia Muslims, Alawites, etc., whom the insurgents seem to have targeted for destruction. Basically, you know, they've destroyed towns where these people have been inhabited. They've destroyed their places of worship. They've destroyed, like, you know, they've killed them. They've, like, captured them, held them hostage, you name it. So the so-called moderate opposition, you know, which the Obama administration has been talking so much about arming and supplying and, like, you know, being like their guys on the ground in Syria, has repeatedly refused to negotiate with the government of Syria. Even though, just as was the case in Libya, the government of Bashar al-Assad has repeatedly offered to do so. They've repeatedly offered to, you know, have to negotiate in good faith. But, of course, every time their overtures basically have been rejected. And not surprisingly, this situation, and combined with the flocking of radical Islamic fundamentalists from more than 80 countries to fight in Syria, has led to the creation of insurgent forces in Syria that are beyond America's control. And so now we have the ISIL, you know, we have the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, the Islamic Caliphate, which, you know, quote unquote, that they have set up there. You know, the murderous, you know, this murderous terror group that the United States claims to be bombing in Syria and Iraq now in order to stop. You know, we have that, the emergence of that effectively based on the United States intervening in the first place and arming and supplying various rebels. So, I mean, this is the same group that, you know, in June, of course, we have, you know, ISIL invading Iraq. And they ended up looting billions of dollars worth of top quality U.S.-supplied military hardware from the U.S.-trained Iraqi army, which ran away, abandoned its positions in the north of the country when ISIS attacked. You know, abandoned all its bases to them, you know, just let them have, like, all the gear, the equipment. They were caught, you know, strangely, they claim to have been caught in a surprise attack, which is a little hard to believe, given that you would think, like, U.S. spy satellites and, like, various, spy infrastructure the U.S. had could have alerted the Iraqi authorities, but they didn't, you know, which is very strange. And just that's one of multiple bizarre incidents that have led to the present situation in the region where direct U.S. military intervention seems more and more likely now. But just as it was in Nicaragua 25 years ago, the aims of American imperialism are clear in Syria, just as they were in Iraq in 2003. They aim at the destruction of a sovereign state that has dared to chart an independent course with regard to politics, economics, and foreign relations. A state that has stood against the Israeli apartheid state for decades, was the USSR's greatest ally in the region, and even sent a cosmonaut into space on a Soviet rocket. I believe that was in the 1980s. And to this day, Syria has stood with Iran and with the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance movements and dared to oppose American foreign policy goals in the region. And for that reason, they have basically been targeted for destruction. You know, it's interesting to note, of course, like the so-called Syrian opposition, which seems to be mostly based in places like Paris, Istanbul, these foreign capital cities, they seem to understand that they can't take power in Syria without an American invasion of the country, at least a massive American bombing campaign in Syria. They can't do that. You know, they know that they need the United States to really intervene in a big way if they want to actually have a chance of taking down Bashar al-Assad and taking power themselves. So, just like the Iraqi opposition in 2003, they've actively been encouraging American intervention from day one. You know, like, how's that, like, what does that say to their loyalty, like, how much they care about the Syrian people when they've been actively pushing for an invasion of their own country, you know, since 2011, basically? Like, what does that say about them? You know, not exactly morally upstanding characters, if you ask me. But I would say, fortunately, you know, despite all this intervention, all the death, all the suffering, all the, you know, the risks now, full-blown invasion, full-blown American intervention in this country, in Syria, just like they did in 2003 in Iraq. Fortunately, the Syrian Arab Army and the Kurdish resistance movement in the northeast of the country have been fighting back and winning against the foreign-backed onslaught that has been targeting their nation. You know, whether that's in Jobar, Adra, Homs, Aleppo, Al-Aqsar, Dera, Kalamun, Palmyra, Deir ez-Zor, Kassab, and, you know, all other kinds of cities and regions across the country. All these cities and regions are being liberated from insurgents. And the Syrian people are gradually being able to return to their homes, you know, over the course of this year and last year. And self-determination, okay, I would just say this in closing. Self-determination is the most fundamental aspect of human dignity. And the Syrian people are willing to fight to the death to defend it. All who oppose imperialism must stand with them in opposing imperialism and U.S. intervention in their land. And this is very important. The crime of Iraq, of the Iraq invasion of 2003, and the absolute carnage and slaughter that led to, must never be repeated. We can never allow that to repeat itself. You know, for the good of humanity. And the prevention of such crimes is everyone's responsibility now. For if we fail to respect the self-determination of all peoples, we can never claim our own. You know, full stop. Full stop. So basically, we really need to take a stand. If that means getting into the streets and demonstrating and, like, you know, basically saying we don't want another war, that's what we need to do. And people are already starting to come out in the streets and, like, really basically opposing this U.S. bombing campaign going on right now in Syria and really trying to push back against that, trying to really drive it home to the politicians and policymakers and the generals and whoever else, that the people refuse to be led by the nose into another war like they were in 2003 in Iraq. You know, they're not going to stand for it again. And, you know, we need to drive that home as much as possible. You know, and of course, the proud Syrian people are certainly fighting back. They don't want their country to be bombed or invaded or any of that kind of stuff. They're taking a stand. They're fighting back. And they're winning against these foreign proxies who have invaded their country and are destroying it. So I would say salute to them, you know, and that's who we stand with.
The United States is against me. The West is against me. Many Arab countries, including Turkey, which is not Arab, of course, against me. And if the Syrian people are against me, how can I be here?
Do you think a foreign invasion is imminent?
I think the price of this invasion, if it's happened, is going too big, more than the whole world can afford.
Do you even have a choice? Because from what it seems from the outside, even if you wanted to go, you wouldn't have anywhere to go.
Exactly.
Where would you go if you wanted to leave?
To Syria.
سيطلق على أهم قارة شبهة النصرة التنظيم الإرهابي في بلاد عقربة وتم دحره
سيد العرب روح رومالي لالي 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 يعلمنا لالي بالعالي غالي 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 اسمك يا وطننا يا غالي تحت جناحه أنا بتخيل أنا سوري أحياني يالي
نحن صوت الضمير
This is the Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Al-Watan Al-Arabiya, which is the, actually it was the Pan-Arab anthem. You know, one of the things a lot of people don't realize is that I believe this happened in 1964, was when there was an attempt by Syria and Egypt, in fact, to form a united Arab Republic to better defend both the their country's interests against basically mostly Western imperialism, like prevent the you know, the return of the colonial powers to that part of the world, to the Middle East, like prevent like you know, the United States, France, Britain from intervening in Middle Eastern affairs. You know, Syria and Egypt actually united as one country for a brief time, like only for a few years in the 1960s. You know, history might have been very, very different if that union had actually persisted. But unfortunately, it did not. Though the present government of Syria certainly still, you know, certainly remains just about the only government in the Arab world, I believe, that really is very strong in promoting Arab unity in the face of imperialism. Like basically saying, yeah, like, you know, there's this such a thing as pan-Arab nationalism. You know, it's like all the Arabs coming together, standing against foreign invasion, like outside, you know, colonialism, imperialist intervention, that sort of thing. Like all, you know, all the different countries standing together, which was a ideological current that existed in the Middle East for a very long time, like especially after the, it basically grew up after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire, after the First World War, and it emerged in resistance to the takeover by the British and the French, who carved up the Middle East between them in the 1920s and 1930s. So increasingly, intellectuals in the Arab world basically started to think about pan-Arab nationalism, the idea that all Arab peoples should unite and take a stand and throw and defeat colonialism, defeat imperialism, you know. And to my knowledge, the only government in the Middle East that still holds true to that, I mean, for a while, like the governments of Iraq and Yemen and Egypt and Libya did, but virtually all those governments are now gone. The only government that still holds true to that ideal, that anti-imperialist ideal, is, in fact, the government of Syria. And they've still, you know, taken a stand on that. Now, what I want to play now is I want to play, this was a clip from RT's Breaking the Set with Abby Martin last year when, if you remember, in 2013, the big, you know, hullabaloo, the big freak out from the United States was that the Syrian government had been using chemical weapons, and the U.S. government tried to use that, you know, the very dubious evidence with regard to that as a pretext for invading the country. You know, they tried to do that. And if you see the kind of arguments that the United States gave last year, they're almost identical in many ways to the excuses being used now to bomb Syria in the name of defeating ISIS. So, you know, it's definitely worth listening to, even though it's a year old. So have a listen. You listen to Back in the USSR.
So guys, as I'm sure you've heard by now, Syria is the new face of the war on terror. Since the Syrian uprising began, over 70,000 people have tragically lost their lives, while millions of others have been displaced. Now, for the last 2 years, the U.S. government and corporate media have been mostly silent on Syria, until the last few months, when the narrative took a significant turn.
The broader point is that once we establish the facts, I have made clear that the use of chemical weapons is a game changer.
The president said the use of chemical weapons against the Syrian people would constitute a red line.
Basically saying that the red line will have been met once there is full and corroborated proof and evidence.
President Obama has talked about red lines.
Yes.
Do you think Bashar al-Assad has crossed a red line?
Not just for one time. Many, many times he crossed the red line.
The president has said that moving the weapons in any kind of threatening way would be that red line.
Israel is determined to prevent the transfer of chemical weapons or other game-changing weaponry by the Syrian regime to terrorists, especially to Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Red line, game changer, chemical weapons, red line, weapons of mass destruction. No, more like a weapon of mass distraction. And no, I'm not saying that Syria should be ignored. What I am saying is that we should all be looking at the bigger picture. First of all, why would chemical weapons be enough of a reason to attack a sovereign nation when the U.S. has consistently used them in modern warfare? Just in the last decade, the U.S. used white phosphorus and radioactive depleted uranium in Iraq, both of which defy international law. But I digress. Back to Syria. eerily similar to the propaganda run-up to the Iraq War, first came the report of chemical weapons being used. Then came the declaration from the Defense Department that Assad was responsible for using them against civilians. And of course, Obama quickly followed by saying that this would not stand. But if there's one thing I hope this nation's learned in the wake of the Iraq WMD debacle, it's that when the war drums are being beaten by the media and the government, the people should demand to see the evidence. Well, according to Reuters, just yesterday, independent UN human rights investigators cited that they had not yet seen evidence of the government forces using chemical weapons in Syria. In fact, through their gathered testimony, the evidence suggests that the rebel forces are the ones who use the chemical nerve gas sarin. And as an alternative to both narratives, just today, the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Syria issued a press release saying it had not reached conclusive evidence of which party is responsible. Here's the deal. Just don't believe everything you see and hear, because there's a lot more going on behind the scenes. Just take a look at the U.S. covert intelligence operations being done on the ground there. You see, the U.S. has been supplying Syria's rebel forces, some of which are affiliated with Al-Qaeda, with illegal arms. So, to fight the war on terror, the U.S. government has chosen to align itself with the same terrorist organization it's fighting across the rest of the world. Well, you know what they say, one government's terrorist is another government's freedom fighter. Which is especially ironic, considering the news that happened over the weekend. The Syrian capital Damascus was rocked by two Israeli airstrikes, in which the Israeli government alleges were merely in self-defense to prevent missiles from reaching Hezbollah. Interestingly enough, Hezbollah also supplies arms to Palestinian resistance. Do you see where I'm going with this whole terrorist is in the eye of the beholder thing? But look, even if the self-defense argument were true, this is undoubtedly a declaration of war on Syria. And guess what? It's not the first time. Back in January, Israel reportedly bombed another shipment of anti-aircraft missiles in Syria, claimed to be headed to Hezbollah. So this latest offensive seems to be falling perfectly in sync with the latest chemical weapons scare. But think about the even bigger picture. Is intervention ever the answer militarily? Assad using chemical weapons should not be justification to become embroiled in another war for profit. Installing a U.S. puppet to replace Assad is not going to help the Syrian people. After all, peace through force is not peace at all.
Okay, you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM. And, of course, that was Abby Martin's report from last year. And, of course, it's very, it still is appropriate, even though that was a year old, that report, which appeared on Breaking the Set, like at the time when, it looked very likely that chemical weapons was, just as it has had been in Iraq, was going to be a pretext for U.S. involvement in Syria as well. But we see what's happened now, of course. I mean, now the United States is basically saying, oh, yeah, we've got to go into Syria because there's this like, these evil, you know, terrorists that we need to kill. You know, it's kind of like, it's an excuse for them to intervene directly in this conflict, you know, which is what they've been wanting to do for a long time. It's just they've been searching and trying so hard to find an excuse to get involved. You know, now, of course, like Stephen Harper wants to get involved too, it seems. But, you know, surprise, surprise. But of course, one of the things that which I have not mentioned yet, of course, is the fact that the United States is also intervening in Iraq now with bombing campaigns and, like, you know, sending in arms and, like, even planning now to put boots on the ground, put actual soldiers back in Iraq, you know, supposedly on the pretext of fighting ISIS, you know. So, I mean, and that's the tragedy. Like, the tragedy that began in 2003 when the United States invaded Iraq has not ended. It's still going on. People are still dying. The intervention is continuing. And, you know, it's as bloody as ever in Iraq and getting bloodier. So, you know, like, there's the tragedy. You know, Iraq's in an even more tragic situation than Syria is. And rather than play for you a clip or a story on that, I think this song sums that tragedy up. So please stay tuned.
Oh. remember when I was growing up. If my mother got angry or frustrated with me, she'd say, "Fish get hello al Haria." And the basic translation of that is, "Oh, how beautiful is freedom." But where is freedom? Place of my mother's birth, the cradle of civilization, for what it's worth. The land I've never seen, culture I've never known. Iraq is in my heart, my blood, my flesh and bones. The air I've never breathed, fragrance I've never smelt. Pride I've never had, the nationality that I've never felt. Saddam was bad, party Americans even more so. They made me grow like I was missing part of my torso. But I never picked up a grenade in my garden. I never saw people I loved die starving. I never saw my family die through many years of sanctions, while the ruler's family lived in palaces and mansions. I never had a family member kidnapped for a ransom, and never lost a friend to violence that was random. Romans occupation, torture, intimidation, a million dead people doesn't equal liberation. On ethnicity or religion, whether you're Sunni, Shia, Kurdish or Christian, pain is still pain if you're a person that's missing. We all deserve a life in this earth that we live in. Is there enough words that can say how deeply Baghdad is burning today? And it's not about pity, hands out, or sympathy. It's about pride, respect, honor and dignity. Babies being born with deformities from uranium. Those babies aren't just Iraqi, they're Mesopotamian. What a view on the news is making me shiver, cause I look at the victims, see the same face in the mirror. This system of division makes it harder for you and me. Peace is a question, the only answer is unity. So many dreams about this place that I've never seen, the place my family had to leave in the 70s. In Fallujah, this is for those that won't live to see the future. Sorry that I wasn't there, sorry that I couldn't help. I'm sorry for every tear, sorry you've been put through hell. Still I feel like an immigrant, Englishman amongst Arabs, and an Arab amongst Englishmen. Like I said, they never gave me the culture, but they did give me Kubad, Halab, Hakaka and Doma. And it is me Kareem, U Umri Talata, U Ishreen, U Mimin Baghdad, Abu Yamin, Dover. And that's the combination that I carry on my shoulders. Still I rep till my death, till they kill and steal my flesh. From now all the way back to Gilgamesh, such a villainized and criticized nation. You will always be the cradle of civilization. In my dreams, motherland, I can still feel you calling me. In my sleep, in my dreams, motherland, I can still feel you calling me. In my sleep, in my dreams, motherland, I can still feel you calling me. I can still feel you calling me. I can still feel you calling me.
Thank you.
back in the USSR. I'll be back after this short break. Please stay tuned.
Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objet d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
Pour les francophones et francophiles de la région, CFRU diffuse l'Éclipse, l'émission musicale française à tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h le matin. Si vous faites partie d'une groupe ou une organisation francophone locale qui veut se faire distinguer ou bien vous voulez contribuer à notre programme, s'il vous plaît, me contactez, Sandra Doucette, par courriel francophone@cfru.ca. Soyez à l'écoute tous les vendredis de 9h à 10h pour les annonces, les événements, d'actualité et bien sûr la bonne musique française.
In Canada, suicide is the second leading cause of death among youth aged 15 to 24. The majority of people who attempt suicide are not sure they want to die, but an overwhelming feeling of hopelessness and lack of support contribute to suicidal behavior. Suicide is more often about wanting to escape a painful and seemingly hopeless situation than about wanting to die. One in five people in Ontario will experience a mental health issue at some point in their life. Stigma or discrimination attached to mental illnesses presents a serious barrier, not only to diagnosis and treatment, but also to acceptance in the community. If someone you know expresses thoughts of suicide, listen, let them talk, be calm, and accept their feelings. Tell someone. Tell an RA, counselor, parent, or doctor. Call the Youth Support Line at 1-888-821-3760.
Yeah, listen to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and just before the break, we had, we heard, you know, a pretty iconic song from Loki, British rapper, singing Cradle of Civilization concerning Iraq. And like I said before, the tragedy that began in 2003 certainly has not ended. And certainly the tragedy, in fact, was going on before 2003, if you know. The sanctions regime that killed up to more than a million children in Iraq during the 1990s after the first Gulf War. So, I mean, decades. You know, it's been going on for decades now. You know, the destruction of Iraq, which in 1990, Iraq actually had the highest standard of living in the entire Middle East. You know, and now it's just this destroyed, you know, divided nation, which is just being pummeled by internal sectarian violence and by outside imperialism and bombing and, like, you name it. It's crazy. Crazy stuff, you know, what's going on right now. But, and it's like, yeah, and they've just suffered so much and have received no justice. You know, and that's, it needs to end. And, like, you know, really need to take a stand. Against what? Against the escalation which is going on now. Which, like I said before, you know, we can't have more war in that region of the world. We can't allow more invasions and more interventions and all this kind of stuff that has led to such great death and suffering. You know, we can't allow that. We have to take a stand on this, folks. So, what I want to get into now is I want to talk a little bit about something which, of course, has been in the media a lot lately, and that, of course, is the question of independence in Scotland, and of course, the Scottish independence vote, which happened like just the other week, was very, very close. It came down to, I think, about, I believe it was about like 50, you know, it wasn't actually much more than 50% that actually voted to stay in the UK. You know, that was over, that was only after like there was an immense scare campaign and like propaganda efforts from every major political party in the UK trying to get Scotland to stay in, and like threats from banks and like, you know, multinational corporations to pull out of Scotland if there was independence, and all this kind of, and you know, the EU saying it might not accept an independent Scotland into the EU, and you know, you name it, there were all kinds of threats to the Scots, like saying, you know, if you dare to secede, you know, there will be consequences. And you can tell that, and seeing that there were all those threats, it's still pretty amazing that, like, you know, the yes vote in that came in was more than 45%. You know, 45% still came out and actually voted yes for independence. And there's been a temptation amongst many Canadians to compare this to the Quebec independence referendums, which have happened in the past. Like, two of them have happened in the past. And the one in the 90s, of course, was very, very close. But given the situation in Britain right now, it's actually quite different. You know, it's quite different. And this is something I think a lot of people on the left really miss when they talk about Scottish independence. Many people don't quite understand the significance of this vote and what it means and what it will continue to mean. Because, of course, even though the Scottish independence vote was lost, the yes side lost, the Scottish National Party, which is pushing for independence, is now like the third biggest political party in the UK. It ballooned by about 17,000 members, new members, after that independence vote, even though they lost. So, I mean, they're still going to be a player. They're pushing for more referendums in the future. And it's interesting because the people who actually voted for independence were mostly young people, mostly people who were working class, you know, and the youth. And that's significant, you know. And I think the best talk I've heard about this has been from Caleb Maupin of Workers' World Party. So I'm going to play that for you right now. This is Caleb Maupin of Workers' World Party talking about Scottish independence. And the real important thing which we need to, you know about the Scottish independence vote, the struggle against austerity in the UK. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
So about 2 weeks ago, I sent a text to some comrades and I said, what is our position on Scottish independence? And they probably rolled their eyes and said, oh, here's Caleb again. You know, he's probably wondering what's the next, what's our position on the 6th Congress or the 3rd International, or, you know, is he asking about Albania this time? You know, what's this about? And there's something to be said for that, because that's the point. Until recent weeks ago, the question of Scottish independence was very abstract. It was something that didn't seem very relevant in the ongoing struggle. And a number of communists and socialists in Britain actually oppose it for that reason. They say the question of Scottish independence is a distraction. And they talk about when they would go onto a college campus and be leafleting and saying to students, let's rally against tuition hikes or rally against the war. There's always somebody who says, oh, let's not focus on that. We just need independence. You know, and it's a distraction. It makes sense that some revolutionary forces might be hostile to it on that basis. And as a party in the USA, we don't feel a need to go around opposing or supporting Scottish independence. This is something for the Scottish working class to decide. However, as a revolutionary party and as Marxists who are constantly scientifically analyzing the world, we can't ignore what happened yesterday. Yesterday, nearly half the voters cast their ballot for independence. 97% of the population was registered to vote. The Yes campaign, urging independence, was staffed mainly by young people, college students, unemployed youth, and they packed university campuses in huge meetings, standing room only, demanding independence. St. George Square in Glasgow was basically turned into a center, with every day having huge rallies for independence. And as it became clear that there was a really good chance that this independence vote may pass, the ruling class, the capitalists, the billionaires, the people who actually rule the world, suddenly got very, very nervous. British Prime Minister David Cameron even announced on Sunday that Britain wouldn't decide what action they were taking in Iraq about airstrikes in Iraq and Syria until the vote had already taken place. Nick Landon, the head of the Financial Stability Committee of the G20, didn't go to the G20 summit in Austria. Instead, he canceled his trip and went back to Scotland to coordinate the efforts to defeat the independence vote. All three major political parties in Britain, the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, and the Liberal Democratic Party, opposed Scottish independence and spent millions of dollars sending their forces there to urge people to vote no. Former Prime Minister Gordon Brown was in Scotland for almost a month begging people to vote no. U.S. President Barack Obama urged people to vote no. British Petroleum and Shell Oil also urged people to vote no. And something was happening. Despite all of this effort to urge people to vote no, there was this huge, huge push among the people for a yes vote. So something was happening. As Marxists, we have to understand what was going on there. Now, Britain was once the top dog of imperialism. There's not a single day that goes by that in the Middle East or in Africa or in Asia, there's not somebody cursing the British Empire and its royal family. Britain rose to prominence as an industrial power with their development of the textile industry. And the cotton that was used in the British textile mills was largely picked by slaves in the U.S. South. And when the Civil War happened, it was the nobles and the big businessmen and the bankers in Britain who were supporting the U.S. South, hoping they could keep the cheap cotton flowing in. The people of India have suffered generations of humiliation and degradation from the British. At one point, India actually had its own textile industry, and it was the British who destroyed it, forcing them to buy their textile from Britain. My ancestors were forced to come to this country because of a man-made famine in Ireland. As a result of conditions set up by British bankers and industrialists, millions of Irish people starved to death. The British Empire established the first Zionist settlements in Palestine. At one point, the majority of Jewish people in the world were socialists and communists, but it was wealthy British bankers who funded the Zionist movement, a racist colonialist movement, and promoted that, and it helped establish the State of Israel, which has committed all these crimes against the people. The people of the Caribbean have suffered horribly. The people of various Asian countries have also suffered horribly, and if we were to go over all the crimes of the British imperialists, we would be here all night. The way the British imperialists made their oppression work was by dividing the working class at home. They gave so-called skilled workers higher wages and a more comfortable lifestyle. And the British government also had a policy of encouraging working class people in Britain to become settlers, sending them over to colonized areas to be overseers and bosses and cops to kind of enforce British rule. In fact, in Lenin's book, Imperialism, he quotes about this. There was a British imperialist who was key in the settlements of Africa, Cecil Rhodes. I know Zimbabwe, before it won its independence, was called Rhodesia after Cecil Rhodes. And Lenin quotes him. He says, "Cecil Rhodes, we are informed by an intimate friend and journalist, expressed his imperialist views to him following the terms, I was in the East End of London," this is Cecil Rhodes talking, "at a meeting in a working class quarter yesterday, attending a meeting of the, it was a meeting about unemployment, and I listened to the wild speeches that were just a cry for bread, bread, bread. And on my way home, I pondered the scene and became ever more convinced of the importance of imperialism, of buying off the working class, giving them some of the crumbs and dividing it." Now, as Wall Street emerged as the dominant imperialist in the 20th century, British imperialism began to decline. And Wall Street is currently playing the role that Britain once played as the center of the world capitalist economy, exploiting the people of the world. After Britain had been destroyed by Nazi bombs in the Second World War, huge measures were taken to keep British people's loyalty to imperialism. A national health care service was created. Free university education was established. The leading political party was the Labour Party, which claimed, falsely, to be a party of socialism. Huge efforts were made to employ British people and you know, wipe out unemployment, create jobs, and a welfare state, what can be called a welfare state, was created. Now, the bankers didn't give a comfortable lifestyle to some of the people in Britain because they felt like it. They did it because they had to. In the 1920s and 30s, British imperialism had been in crisis, and the British working class had fought back. Britain had been shut down with a general strike in 1926. During the 1930s, the Communist Party of Great Britain had a huge amount of influence in the labor movement. In the hunger marches, workers and miners who were laid off and unemployed in Scotland would march all the way down to London, demanding jobs and wages. In 1936, there was a British Nazi named Oswald Mosley who wanted to hold a parade in support of Hitler in London on a place called Cable Street. And the communists in Britain organized a march, and it was Irish workers, English workers, Scottish workers, Southeast Asian workers, African workers joined together, and they blocked this march. It was called the Battle of Cable Street, and it's celebrated all over the world. Before and during the Second World War, a clear majority of British people held a favorable opinion of the Soviet Union. British workers saw that the King of England had actually been forced to step down because he'd been so sympathetic to the Nazis, and many of the bombs that fell on British workers had been purchased with loans from British banks that had loaned it to the Nazis. One of the most amazing things that the British Communist Party did was it occupied the subways. You know, in London, while the British were being bombed by the Nazis, in the working class areas, the government wasn't providing shelters to people. And so the Communist Party clubs went down into the subways and occupied it, said, "We need to be here to get protection." And when the police came in to drive them out, they fought them, and they demanded their right to occupy the subways. Now, the welfare state that was created after the, especially escalated after the Second World War, was devoted to winning British people's loyalty to empire. And in the last 60 years, British people in England, Scotland, and Wales have become become accustomed to a comfortable lifestyle with high wages, social programs, free health care, and other benefits. But that's changing. Now, just like in the 1930s, the Western capitalist world is facing an economic crisis. In the name of austerity, British university students now have to pay for their education in many parts of the country. Government workers are being laid off or having their pensions slashed. A bedroom tax has been created, which in some cases cuts the income of low-paid or disabled workers in half. Can you imagine that? You get taxed for having an extra bedroom in your house, and it cuts your income in half. In Britain, there is a huge amount of unemployment among the youth, and the youth who are employed get very low wages and have far less protection on the job than their parents. Sound a little bit familiar? In 2011, there was a huge explosion of youth in Britain who rebelled, breaking into stores. It was a huge episode of social unrest. And there have been massive protests by the unions and on the college campuses. The movement for Scottish independence is very much part of the resistance to austerity. So let's talk about Scotland now. Scotland is definitely a nation. It has a national heritage. It has a national language, which has been suppressed. It has its own distinct religious groups, which have developed independently. It has its own unique culture and history. Scotland is a nation, but it is also a nation within the British imperialist homeland. Scottish bankers make super profits exploiting the Third World, just like English ones do. Scotland is not part of the oppressed world, and it's not a colony of England. The struggle for Scottish independence is not a classic national liberation struggle like in Ireland or Puerto Rico or in Palestine or other countries from the oppressed world that are trying to break free. The overwhelming majority of the billionaires and bankers are opposed to Scottish independence, but not all of them are. There are a number of Scottish capitalists who think that they could get a better deal under independence. One of the big issues in the independence vote was the natural gas and oil resources. Independence would have put control of these resources and the billions of dollars to be made from them up for grabs. It would have taken it out of the hands of BP and Shell and it would have given other capitalists a chance to move in. However, to the millions of Scottish youth who went out and campaigned for independence, it wasn't about oil and it wasn't even really about the national question. Scotland is a stronghold for the unions and for the Labour Party. In the last 51 years, never have the Scottish people voted in their majority for the Conservative Party. Scotland is part of a country where workers have lower incomes on average, and they tend to be more liberal, especially on economic issues. University education is no longer free for the majority of British students, but in Scotland, they've refused to take it away. Millions of people who voted for independence yesterday were not exactly voting for independence from the United Kingdom. They were voting for independence from the Conservative Party. They were voting to stop the cuts in public education, voting to stop the cuts in the National Health Service, and voting to stop the cuts in the child care programs. They were voting to preserve the jobs of government workers. They were voting to rally, and they were voting, and they were rallying their friends to vote in the millions. I mean, it was a mass movement, you know, and kind of came out of nowhere. They didn't see it coming. You know, they decided that there would be a referendum on independence in 2011, and it was like almost they assumed they would never pass, but then almost out of nowhere it seemed like there was this huge upsurge of people wanting independence. Now, the Scottish National Party and the Scottish Socialist Party, which dominate the local governments in Scotland, called for the immediate nationalization of certain industries if there had been independence. Now, many of the activists in the Scottish independence movement actually pointed out that if Scotland had won its independence, it wouldn't have been real independence. They would have been part of the Commonwealth. They would have still had to recognize the Queen. The military would have remained united, and they would have kept the British pound as their currency. But one of the big grievances of the Scottish people is that the nuclear weapons that are owned by the British military are being stored in Scotland. And they're there, even though numerous times the people in Scotland, in their overwhelming majority, we're talking like 90%, have said they don't want those nuclear weapons there. But every time it's up for a vote for them to be moved, it's not. It's voted down, and the nuclear weapons stay up there. Until a few weeks ago, no one really thought that it would be possible. But then when this movement, you know, came in, the bourgeoisie spent billions of dollars to try and urge people to vote no. And now the vote came down. It was a close vote, but it was a vote no. But now there have been more than 10 instances of fraud reported. In one urban area called Dundee, twice while the votes were being counted, the fire alarm went off. And when people got back into the building, all the tables had been moved around. And there's actually a video that's surfaced in another area of a woman. Someone videoed a woman vote counting, and she's clearly distorting, and she's moving it around. So there's instances of fraud. Now, the young people who have been rallying in St. George Square in Glasgow demanding independence, they haven't given up. But just today, the neo-Nazis, the British National Party, which is an ultra-right-wing party, went to the square in Glasgow and fought with the youth. And there have been scuffles there between the youth that want the Yes campaign, want independence, and these ultra-right-wing Nazi groups. So we have to understand Scottish independence in these terms. Revolutionaries are a lot like dentists. there's a small minority of people that ever since they were kids, you know, they were playing with the doll's teeth and they read all about teeth and were obsessed with teeth. But for most of us, we really don't want anything to do with dentists unless we have to. But you get in that situation where you've got a cavity and it hurts so bad, or that filling fell out and you've got to find a dentist, right? And that's how it is for most people. That's how it is. And we in this room, we represent the vanguard. We're the section of society that's always thinking about revolution. We dream about revolution every night and we work like hell for it every day. But we're a small section of society. But when the rest of society gets into a situation where things just can't get better and those wages keep just going down and the oppressive state just keeps coming down on us, all of a sudden they start looking for revolutionaries. The working class, if it really wants to be free, it can't align with any capitalists. It has to be working independently, fighting in its own interest against all the capitalists and all the bankers and all the billionaires. But that's going to be difficult. And the recent explosions that we see in places like Ferguson, Missouri, or the Occupy events of 2011, or what's happening in Scotland is the working class gradually waking up and learning how to fight. So that's what's happening. The capitalist crisis is forcing all kinds of things that never would have been up for discussion onto the table. And this issue of Scottish independence is a real revelation of that. It was the youth, it was the working class, the votes for independence were the strongest in the most working class and oppressed areas with the unemployment. This was a struggle against austerity. The working class is gradually waking up, and so we as a revolutionary party have to be where these explosions come into, these spontaneous explosions of the workers, and we need to point them in a revolutionary direction. So I just want to end. There was a song that Francis Dostal taught me, a founding member of the party, and it was a song, and one of the verses, and it was in the 1930s, she learned it as a child in the Young Communist League. It's called the United Front Song, and I just wanted to sing one of the verses, and I'll end with that. The worker is the worker, and there is no other road to liberty, for only the working class alone can end wage slavery. No, I... Come my head, come my body.